Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Roughly 2 billion people around the world log into Facebook on a regular basis. Since its founding in 2004, the company has grown very rapidly, gobbling up other popular apps from Instagram to WhatsApp. And with that growth have come scandals associated with how Facebook markets its users, causing some to abandon the site. A new study shows that might not be a bad thing when it comes to psychological well-being. Luca Bragieri of Stanford University is one of the authors of the study. It's entitled The Welfare Effects of Social Media. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
Luca, how did you conduct the research?
So the basic idea is as follows. We randomized, we recruited a group of people from Facebook, actually, and we tried to be representative of the overall Facebook population in the U.S. We randomized half of them to a treatment group, the other half to a control group, and we paid the treatment group $102 to deactivate their Facebook account for a month. This way, we can study the effect of Facebook deactivation on a variety of outcomes of interest, such as well-being.
How many of them cheated?
In the treatment group, we had something like 600 people.
And that cheated?
That cheated?
Yeah.
not too many. Actually, people complied to a very large extent. We were positively surprised.
How do you measure well-being?
Yeah, so there are standard measures of well-being. So we basically use mostly surveys. And there are standard surveys that people do. So some of them ask about happiness, something like over the last 4 weeks, how happy were you? And it goes from like not very happy to very happy. Some of them ask about life satisfaction. For instance, to what extent do you agree with the following sentence? In most ways, my life during the past 4 weeks was close to ideal. Then we ask about loneliness, depression, anxiety, et cetera, et cetera.
You paid users to give up Facebook for a month. How did you land on that $102?
So we piloted the experiment, and we figured out that a lot of people with approximately $100, we would get something like 60% of people to be willing to deactivate their account. And given the budget we had, we figured that was a good number.
The study occurred in the run-up to the 2018 midterm election, so very recently, and I was wondering why you picked that time period.
Yes, yeah, because we don't just study effects of Facebook deactivation on subjective well-being. We also study political outcomes, such as knowledge about the news and political polarization. And we figured that time would be a time in which probably a lot of news would come out and a time in which polarization may be salient.
And how did it affect people's level of knowledge about current events?
Yeah, so interestingly, we found that people who are paid to deactivate their Facebook accounts, so people in the treatment group, actually know less about the news than people in the control group. So this seems to run counter the standard narrative, which is one in which Facebook spreads misinformation.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a new study. It occurred, as I said, during the run-up to the 2018 midterm elections, and it looked at people in a treatment group that were paid $102 a month to deactivate their Facebook and what the impact was on their psychological welfare. My guest is Luca Bragieri. He's from Stanford University. He's one of the authors of the study. It was titled The Welfare Effects of Social Media. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Conversely, Luca, the people who stayed on Facebook, the control group, were subjected to a lot of, I guess, stressful messaging when it came to politics and current events, right?
Yeah, that's possible. So we don't know exactly what they saw on their walls,
mm-hmm.
because we don't have access to that. But you can imagine that there would be a lot of political stuff being shared around that time.
You checked on how people were doing with text messaging. How did that work?
Yeah, so among the various measures of well-being that we have, some of them are, we asked them towards the end of the experiment in a survey, and so these are measures that ask about the past 4 weeks, and some of them we ask basically every day. We try to get at their well-being instantaneously. And that's why we do the text messages. So every day of the experiment, we send our participants, both in treatment and control, a text message that asks them either how happy they are on a scale from 1 to 10, how lonely they are on a scale from 1 to 10, and what's the dominant emotion they felt over the last 10 minutes.
How many people felt like they were missing out on something, or did you ask that at all?
Yeah, we did. We did. We asked, to what extent do you agree with the following statement? If people deactivated their Facebook account, they would realize they don't miss it at all. And people in the treatment group actually disagreed with the statement more than people in the control group. So people in the treatment group who actually did go through a month of deactivation figured out that Facebook was useful to them in a variety of ways, and that they actually missed it when they were not on it.
And the people, go ahead. And I guess you're saying the people in the control group that didn't give up Facebook miscalculated that.
Exactly. To some extent, it appears to be the case.
So people don't know how much they love their Facebook.
Yeah, so definitely people who are not on Facebook, people whom we paid to deactivate Facebook, said they missed it a lot. However, interestingly, what we found is that after the experiment is over, people in the treatment group use Facebook less than people in the control group. So to some extent, this 1 month of deactivation changed the way people use the platform.
Let's see. Steve in Columbus, you're on the air with Luca Braghieri of Stanford University. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
So I work as a law enforcement intelligence analyst, and I spend a lot of time and gather a lot of information from social media and Facebook. But I also see a lot of crazy things on Facebook, drugs for sale, all sorts of things. So I did get sort of burnt out on it after a while. And I, of course, have my own personal accounts.
Mm-hmm.
I eventually got off Facebook, and I was off Facebook and all social media for about a year. And psychologically, I have to agree with your guest. I was happier. I was reading more, seeing more movies, just more at peace. But I came to found out, I was sort of missing out on more functional things, I guess.
Like what?
Well, the perfect example is I got a phone call one weekend asking if I was on my way, and I didn't know what. I was supposed to be someplace or something. There was some birthday party I was invited to, and everyone just assumed that I knew about it through Facebook. And so I completely I was missing out on social events, missing out on, what's going on with my family and friends. So functionally, I did sort of feel the need to get back on Facebook. So I did go for about a year, though, without it. And I think it was worth it. It was time well spent, but I just had to get back on it. It's hard to live without it nowadays.
Yeah, you get connected. My two best oldest friends, neither of them have ever been on Facebook. And we text all the time, but I get what you're saying, Steve. I mean, people find out about parties, they find out about birth announcements, death announcements, that kind of a thing. Luca Braghieri, he makes some interesting points.
Yeah, so I completely agree. Facebook does a lot of things, right? A lot of people look at their Facebook for news. They keep in touch with friends that live far away. They get invited to birthday parties and the like. So I guess the point of our research is not trying to suggest to people to be off Facebook, not at all. I guess we're just trying to give people a bit more information so that they can use the platform a bit more consciously. Mm. So maybe one thing that could be, that people could do is, there are certain parts of Facebook that you may not like very much, or that may not be great for you in terms of your well-being. Well, limit that and stick to the invitations and things you find valuable. So use the platform a bit more consciously. That, I guess, is one of the takeaways.
And, you know, Steve, when he described what else he was doing instead of Facebook, that rings a lot of bells, too, right? I mean, it was a lot of what people described, how they replace their social media time in your study.
Definitely, exactly. So one of the things we study is time substitution. So since people spend a lot of time on Facebook, approximately an hour a day, a bit less than that, people in our treatment group had once per hour. And so what did they do with that? And what we find is that they spend a bit more time watching TV, doing non-screen activities, you can imagine exercise, reading, etc., and spending time with friends and family. So we thought that was interesting and very much in line with what Steve was saying.
There, you mentioned less polarization. That was something that people felt very much.
Yeah, So the politics part of the research I find very interesting, and that's the one in which people are less informed about the news, but they're also less polarized. And where we measure polarization using survey measures, I think that the survey measure I like the most is a variable called issue polarization. What that is works as follows. So we ask people about their opinions on issues of the day. You can imagine gun control, for instance, and we ask them, to what extent do you think that the U.S. should have tighter gun control laws? And people answer on a spectrum that goes from definitely tighter gun control laws to definitely not tighter gun control laws. So you can think that going from Democrat to Republican, from extreme Democrat to extreme Republican. And we ask them many questions like this, and then we aggregate their answers. And what we find is that the answers of people in control, the average Democrat answer in control and the average Republican answer in control are further away from each other than the average Democrat answer in treatment and the average Republican answer in treatment. What that means is that people who are off Facebook, so people in our treatment group, Democrats and Republicans seem to have, their opinions seem to be less polarized. They seem to be closer to one another.
So your conclusions, you said it's not to get off Facebook, to be more conscious of how you use it.
Yeah, definitely. That would be my takeaway. I think we provided a lot of information that people may not have had before. So there was no study like this. Well, there were some studies like this before, but I guess this was the largest study of this kind. And so we managed to say things that were not obvious before. For instance, the effects on well-being, I think, were, you know, people speculated about them, but I guess it didn't quite have solid evidence. So I think we provide some of the solid evidence, and then people, now that they're more informed, can just take it from there and decide how to use the platform.
Is it fair to extrapolate this to other social media platforms?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I think it varies. So I think about Twitter, for instance. I would be inclined to believe that the effects on well-being on Twitter would be quite different from the effects on Facebook, just because on Twitter, people seem to share different things from what they share on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas on Instagram, I'd be more inclined to believe that the effects on well-being are similar to the ones on Facebook. So I don't know. We don't know for sure based on our research, mm-hmm. and I think it's not obvious.
And then what's next in your interest when it comes to this issue?
Yeah, so there is another project that I would like to work on at some point when I get the data, and that is having a different way of studying the effects of Facebook on mental health, things like depression. Okay, so one thing that I worried about in this study is something that is called experimenter demand effect, which basically means in this study, people knew that they were deactivating the Facebook account, obviously, and so they may have brought to the discussion when they answered the questions about well-being, what they thought about Facebook overall. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they thought that Facebook makes people unhappy, and that influenced what they answered to the survey.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's a little worry that I have. And so I would like to find a different way of measuring some of the same outcomes that does not involve demand effects. And that's something I'm working on next.
All right. Well, Luca Braghieri, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Luca Braghieri of Stanford University is one of the authors of the study entitled The Welfare Effects of Social Media. We'll have a link for more information on that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Federal Communications Commission last week defended its 2017 repeal of net neutrality before a three-judge panel. The court case, Mozilla versus FCC, challenges whether the FCC was within its rights to overturn the Open Internet Order, which prohibited so-called Internet fast lanes. Washington Post technology reporter Brian Fung has been covering the issue. He joins us by phone. Welcome back, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Mozilla is known as an advocate for open internet. Who's joining that company in this lawsuit? Who do they represent?
Well, you've got a number of tech companies involved, like Etsy and Vimeo. Also involved on that side, you have a number of state and local officials, including the heads of Santa Clara County, California, which was the center of a controversy involving Verizon and firefighters last year. And you also have a number of consumer groups and other advocates as well. So all in all, it's a pretty broad array of interests.
And what happened in the arguments the other day?
Well, over the course of the entire day, you had the FCC essentially defending its decision to reclassify internet service under lighter regulations, and you had folks like Mozilla saying that the agency had not followed the rules appropriately when it was trying to arrive at that decision, and the folks who were from state and local government also challenged the FCC on the grounds that the agency didn't consider the impact that the repeal would have on public safety officials.
And how did the FCC respond to those arguments?
Well, the FCC had a number of responses to the various arguments. Their chief argument was that the Supreme Court in 2005 had issued a precedent under a case known as Brand X that legally allowed them to reclassify internet service as a lightly regulated information service, and that was sort of the main argument that they were presenting. But when it came to questions about public safety and whether or not the agency was going too far in citing the just one or two sources of authority for some of its decision making, the judges had some very, very tough questions for the commission.
Their argument has to do with the Open Internet Order. Tell us what that means and what role it plays.
Sure. So the Open Internet Order was the FCC's attempt in 2015 to implement some of the principles behind net neutrality. Net neutrality, of course, is the idea that internet providers shouldn't be allowed to speed up or slow down websites or apps on the internet, based on their own preferences, that everything should be treated equally and that you as a consumer should be able to access all forms of internet content without restrictions.
Mm-hmm. And this was overturned or repealed, I guess, in 2017, right?
That's right. So the FCC in 2016 successfully defended the net neutrality rules from a lawsuit by internet providers, having been defeated in court. Opponents of the open internet order tried to change the rules from within. You had FCC Chairman Ajit Pai beginning in 2017 launching an initiative to try and repeal the rules, which they did in December of 2017, and that has landed us now in court as companies like Mozilla have tried to challenge that decision.
Is Pai still in charge over there?
He is. At the moment, you have three Republicans and two Democrats on the commission. Typically, the commission changes hands, when a new administration comes into power. When we had President Trump take office, that was when he elevated Commissioner Pai to become chairman.
And does this fall along political lines? I mean, Republicans tend to advocate for repealing the open internet order, and Democrats otherwise.
Well, it is and it isn't a partisan issue. On one level, you have a lot of Republican officials who view this as, a partisan debate where essentially they argue that the rules hindered businesses like Verizon and AT&T from making money, while you had, Democrats largely in Congress saying, these rules represent a fundamental consumer protection. On the other hand, if you look at surveys of actual Americans, the electorate is much more united in their support for rules that resemble the original open internet order. So it is much more bipartisan once you get out of Washington.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Washington Post technology reporter Brian Fung about the Federal Communications Commission, which last week defended its 2017 repeal of net neutrality before a three-judge panel. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Brian, what kind of latitude does this three-judge panel have in deciding anything?
Well, they have an extremely wide amount of latitude. They could decide everything. They could decide to do everything from striking down the FCC decision entirely to just sort of nibbling at the edges and saying, we don't like these parts. We're going to send it back to you for revisions. They could, completely uphold the FCC. It's a completely open field at the moment. We're just going to have to wait and see how the judges end up ruling on it.
Do we know when they'll make their decision?
Well, a lot of legal experts say that we should expect a decision by sometime this summer. That's sort of the same time frame that we had with the last time net neutrality went to court in 2015 and 2016. So I think it would be fair to expect that the court will issue an opinion sometime perhaps in May or June.
There was a lot of activism, correct me if I'm wrong, but back in 2017 when they were considering this repeal, is there the same level of activism and interest at this point?
I would say at this point it's kind of died down a little bit, because of how complicated the issue has become. We're seeing very detailed and complex legal arguments being made here in court, not all of which are easily understandable by a lay audience, and so some of this stuff has gotten very, very arcane. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be a surprise to me the amount of activism surrounding net neutrality has diminished somewhat.
Hmm. And it went into effect. The repeal did go into effect, right?
Yes, it did. As of last summer, the repeal went into effect, and so currently, internet providers have the legal leeway to slow down internet sites or block them or speed up ones that they do like. All they have to do is disclose the fact on their websites or to the FCC, and that behavior is entirely permissible.
And have we seen much of that?
At the moment, we have not. You have dueling arguments as to why we haven't seen this come out much, apparently. You have internet providers saying they're not interested in blocking or slowing down internet content anyway. You have companies like Mozilla saying internet providers are mainly on their best behavior right now because of this looming legal decision by the DC Circuit, and that explains why the providers haven't done more. At this point, it's just fair to say that none of the warnings that activists put forward during the decision-making process have yet truly come to pass in a widespread manner, but that could always change in the future.
I wanted you to go back to the argument that the FCC didn't first consider first responders or other emergency communications when repealing net neutrality. Why is that a concern? What's the connection there?
Yeah, so this was actually kind of a surprisingly large focus of the court in oral arguments on Friday. I don't think very many people were expecting the judges to focus so keenly on this topic. But, the issue here that public safety officials are raising is that it's within the FCC's congressional mandate to consider public safety whenever it issues a decision of any kind. And so, given that, according to the critics of the FCC, Chairman Pai didn't do enough to address how the repeal of the net neutrality rules could negatively affect public safety officers and first responders, that's grounds for the rules to be overturned.
Well, how could they negatively affect first responders? What would that have to do with that?
Yeah, the argument that first responders are putting forward here is, imagine a scenario where, consumers are trying to get access to information about a disease outbreak on a public health website run by a local government. In a situation where the provider of the public health website is working through a mass market retail internet service as opposed to, a commercial internet service provider, the fear there is that some consumers might be delayed or, in getting that crucial information or might not be able to access that information at all. And that would be, a critical failure of the first responder and public safety, ecosystem.
And did the FCC have a defense for that? Did they say, no, yes, we did check on the connection and we found that it wouldn't be a challenge?
Well, it's not exactly clear what the FCC's argument is in response to that. The judges and the FCC went sort of back and forth on that issue for some time without really arriving at a conclusion. One possibility that one of the judges raised was, why couldn't you have written a net neutrality rule that permitted internet fast lanes more broadly, but then, had a carve out for first responders? And, the FCC's response was, well, we're not sure if, such a rule could actually pass judicial muster. It's not clear, they didn't really get into it much more beyond that. It is sort of an interesting question as to what is the FCC's obligation here and to what extent the FCC has fulfilled it.
What is the sense about how the D.C. Circuit will rule in this case? Is there any precedent, anything that can give us some clues?
Yeah, well, if you look at the court case from a number of years ago that dealt with net neutrality involving Verizon and suing the FCC, the one outcome there was that the court said, that the authority you've relied on here is too broad. We're going to send this back to you for revisions. And I think, the emerging consensus here in Washington is that the FCC might have to do the same thing here, where the court says, these rules, cite an insufficient sort of source of power for from the commission. We think you should go back to the drawing board, which would give Chairman Pai another bite at the apple in trying to rewrite these rules. But then, you kind of run into another question, which is that, you know, can those rules survive an effort by congressional opponents of the FCC to overturn the decision, the FCC's decision, with an act of Congress?
Right. I was going to ask you, now that Democrats are in control of the House, does that change the equations in any significant way?
I think it does, and here's why. You know, you may remember last year there was an effort by congressional Democrats to launch what's called a CRA, a Congressional Review Act petition. And what that would have done, had it passed, would have been to essentially have Congress overrule the FCC. Now, that legislation would still have required a signature by President Trump, and Trump is on record as having defended the FCC's decision. Mm-hmm. But the issue there for Democrats was, you know, the before they even got to that point, was they didn't have the votes or the signatures in the House to really push this legislation forward. But now that they're in control of the House, and they already had, you know, enough signatures in the Senate, it's likely that any effort to try and push through another CRA in response to a second attempt by Pai to write a new net neutrality rule could pass.
Is there, now that the, you know, it was it the 10th or 12th Circuit in D.C., now that they're considering this, has there been any effort to stay the FCC decision, or is it just going to go forward like it has since 2017?
Well, at the moment, there's no injunction on the books, at the D.C. Circuit. The judges have permitted the rules to stay in place while it's being litigated. So as of this moment, we are still living in a world where the net neutrality rules have been repealed.
Okay. Brian Fung, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it, as always.
My pleasure.
That's Brian Fung. He is a Washington Post technology reporter. We've been talking about the arguments before the Washington, D.C. Circuit Court. Last week, the Federal Communications Commission defended its 2017 repeal of net neutrality. Before that, three-judge panel will be keeping up with that as it moves along. More Tech Tuesdays coming up with Russell Holley on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Marshall, the music company, has for many years manufactured amplifiers. You might spot one of these on a stage during a concert. But along with amplifiers, the company makes headphones and speakers. And the most recent product, the Kilburn 2, provides a retro feel to a portable speaker. Joining us to talk speakers and more is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So what's retro about the design?
Well, so it looks like a classic Marshall amplifier. If you are a musician, you would recognize the design immediately as something that is just very classically Marshall designed, complete with the strap that goes across the top and the flashy kind of Marshall logo going across the face of it, and really just the whole boxy shape of it. Unless you were a musician familiar with Marshall speakers at a distance, you probably would look at this and wonder, what this tiny guitar amplifier was doing sitting on, a shelf or at a beach or something.
Okay, and so they improved it. They made it more contemporary when it comes to how it puts it out.
Yeah, the technology that goes inside of it is definitely an upgrade. This is not a tube amplifier or anything like that. This is a very traditional kind of Bluetooth amplifier, but what Marshall is doing is using its speaker technology to make sure that the equipment that's in it is very high quality. A lot of, traditional Bluetooth speakers aren't really known for the best quality sound. Some of them can get pretty loud, but they're really designed to, fill a room, a pretty reasonably sized room, or stick in a bathroom, or maybe have by the pool. and just, you know, be a reasonable and often inexpensive Bluetooth speaker. The Marshall speakers, on the other hand, were designed to be, you know, big, almost a throwback to boomboxes from, you know, from the 80s. You know, this was a big speaker that you carry around and has a great big battery in it that allows you to generate just a lot of sound. It's very loud, it's very high quality, and that was, you know, Marshall's big thing from the beginning, and this is, you know, kind of the newer version of that with just, you know, more modern technology inside of it.
Why the retro look to begin with? Is just everything retro? Is it all, it's just a phase that tech's going through right now?
I'm sure some of it is just, you know, the nostalgia hit that is kind of washed over technology in general right now. But really, this is a classic Marshall design. And the people who are going to buy this are going to see it on a shelf and go, oh, man, that looks just like a Marshall amplifier. And those are going to be the people who are going to be interested in this in the first place. If seeing this on a shelf at Best Buy, unless you know, you know, what Marshall is as a company and what they've produced, it's not something that's going to stand out appreciably well from the other speakers sitting on the shelf. So that's, they know that this company knows that it has to approach that very specific audience.
Yeah. So how big is that audience?
Well, it's big enough that, you know, last year it was one of the more popular speakers that was sold at a lot of Best Buy locations, you know, in its price tier. These are, you know, fairly expensive speakers compared to what I think a lot of people have in their home. Mm-hmm. But the whole design, you know, had sold really well last year, and Marshall decided that in order to be more competitive this year, they would release this updated model with some additional hardware inside.
Let's see, $300 about, right?
Yeah, they started about $250 for a lot of these. There's the battery inside is designed to last up to 20 hours, and they're a little on the heavy side. Like this, you know, is something that you're unlikely to toss over your shoulder and carry around. It, you know, it almost carries like an amplifier, which is kind of funny.
And you said the battery life's 20 hours. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's a solid, you know, 20 straight hours of music is pretty good for most Bluetooth speakers, in particular some of the larger ones, because they're, you know, using a lot more power to produce more sound.
Any downfalls? Just the weight, you think, or anything else?
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest thing is that it's heavy, and if you're not familiar with the brand, it's a little on the expensive side. You know, one of the things that we're starting to see with a lot of these kind of higher-end Bluetooth speakers is that they often are Alexa-enabled or have some, you know, Google Assistant-enabled to have some kind of Wi-Fi connectivity to make it so that you can pull music from more places than just your phone.
Mm-hmm.
And this does not have that. This speaker is just a Bluetooth speaker, so you connect it to your phone, and as long as your phone is in range, then you can continue to use speaker, you know, use those kind of things. But it's not really the smart speaker that you know, you see kind of commonly talked about right now.
Okay. You wanted to talk about the Division 2, a squad-based shooter game. What does that mean? That means you're playing with other people in a team?
You have the option to, yeah. The Division was a game that came out a couple years ago, and the idea was you had a four-person squad that you could you can jump in, that each had kind of their own specialties that you could jump through and work together in order to take out other four-person squads online. It was largely an online game, and it didn't have a ton of, you know, story to it. It had, you know, some information about what it was that your team was doing, and it was built in the Tom Clancy universe for the you know, the literary series to go with it, like so many other, you know, Tom Clancy stories that have been turned into video games. But the Division 2 kind of takes that and flips it around a little bit and focuses very heavily on story. There's a 40-hour campaign that you can play through entirely with, you know, up to four people before you even consider doing anything online, which is less common now with a lot of games. And it's very well done. The entire concept was surprisingly good.
Washington, D.C. is under siege in this game. Why Washington, D.C.? What do you make of that? And I know you're from a suburb of Washington, D.C. What does it look like?
It was surprisingly accurate. One of the missions actually takes place inside the Air and Space Museum, and it was something that I had actually been to the week before and kind of laughed at the people that I was playing with during the demonstration that I was provided with did not know the layout very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very excited to kind of shout, you know, the moon lander is in the next room, and then there it was when you walk through the doorway. But, you know, so it's a fairly faithful recreation of Washington, D.C., albeit overrun in such a way that it feels like a war zone. You know, there's quite a bit of kind of rebellious factions that have tried to take over the city in various ways, and your goal is to slowly move your way from place to place and kind of liberate different groups of civilians so that they can, you know, kind of help you take back Washington, D.C.
What you call this role-playing game completely modular. What do you mean by that?
So with a lot of role-playing games, you pick a thing. You know, you want to be the person who specializes in a certain type of weapon or that specializes in a certain type of skill. And especially in, you know, modern shooter-based video games, it's usually limited to, specific growth patterns. So you pick the character that focuses on a certain type of weapon, and you can only kind of grow in that general direction. The Division 2 has what's called an open skill tree, so that you can pick... You want your character to have the ability to carry significantly more ammunition than they did at the start. You can choose that as your focus, or if you want to focus on certain gadgets that give you an upper hand in targeting different opponents, or in drones that can fly overhead and see, you know, farther and give you some tactical advantage that way. You can choose that as a specialty and have it not directly impact any of the other things that you have chosen throughout the game.
Is that what you're talking about when you talk about the game's choice-based philosophy?
Yeah, this is something that Ubisoft as a company, the company behind this game, has been doing with several games. The most notable within the last year was Assassin's Creed Odyssey, where the ability to, you know, really kind of shape the character as your own and make it something that is, you're unlikely to run into another character that is set up exactly the same way that you are. And that's an important, you know, kind of step forward in the way that these games are designed.
Is it, well, anything negative about the game that you think they could improve on?
So I think the biggest thing is, you know, kind of the availability for different kinds of systems is a little on the limited side. So you have, you know, your very standard kind of controller setup, and it's not, it doesn't really expand beyond a very familiar game mechanic. So you kind of run up and you hide behind something and you shoot the other person, and then you kind of run up to another thing and you hide behind it. So if you're not a fan of this kind of game, it can become very repetitive. And that is really just a personal taste thing. You either are, you know, familiar with this gameplay style and really like it. There are a lot of games that are built very similar to this. So that gameplay can be familiar and enjoyable, or it can be familiar and unfortunately repetitive, depending on who you are.
Well, you said it's almost a perfect sequel to the original game.
Yeah, so I enjoyed the original game, but it was limited by not having a proper, you know, campaign story mode, and that's something that
online
gaming. So, you know, a big part of this is taking all of the things that made the first game a lot of fun and also just adding in a ton more to do. And this is a starting point for this game is, you know, what we see now. The company behind the game is actually planning multiple expansions to go further into Washington, D.C., and be able to explore more of the game, the area around, and you know, just do more with the surrounding areas.
All right, you mentioned the smartwatch TicWatch E2. It's only costs about $160. It's an affordable option. Is it a good one?
Yeah, it's actually surprisingly good for what it is you're getting. We see a lot of, you know, these kind of inexpensive watches that run on the Android platform, and they tend to slow down a little bit over time, or they are missing, you know, kind of major features like being waterproof. You know, being able to survive getting wet occasionally is a pretty important thing for a computer you wear on your wrist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that gets kind of cut back from a lot of these designs. And TicWatch is a not particularly well-known company that's been making really great watches at pretty reasonable prices for a couple of years now. And this is a continuation of their less expensive version. So it's like you said, $160 watch. And one of the big features that it comes with is that it can survive up to five atmospheres of depth.
So for the lay people of among us out there, what does that mean?
It would be several hundred feet. You're not going to you're not going to worry, unless you are a diver, about going down deep enough that this watch would be damaged by water.
You can go play in the ocean.
You could absolutely go play in the ocean. You're just not going to, you would need actual diving equipment to get down deep enough, or I would rather require diving equipment to to get down deep enough where it would be a concern that this water, that this watch would take on water damage.
Probably for a lot of people, the most familiar smartwatch is the Apple Watch. So can you compare and contrast it to that?
So starting
with what it looks like, yeah.
Yeah, so when it comes to that particular waterproof feature, they are actually both capable of going down to 5 atmospheres. The biggest difference that you'll see between the two of these, if you were to look at them side by side, Apple has a very traditional, kind of squarish design. You see it, and it very much looks like an Apple Watch. There are very few other things that look like it, whereas the Tick Watch looks more like a watch. It's a round watch that sits on your wrist. It's a little thicker than the Apple Watch, kind of by design. It's got a larger battery in it that's designed to get you up to 2 days of regular use, but it also doesn't look like a particularly fashionable watch. This looks very much kind of a not a rugged watch, but a kind of sporty watch by design.
And does it, like, pick up calls and messages and that kind of a thing?
Yeah, so this actually runs on the Android Wear platform, and a big part of that is being able to communicate directly with your phone and deliver notifications from your phone and being able to, access all of your notifications and your fitness tracking functionality, and all of that, those things are kind of by default built into that platform.
It's the second version of the Tick Watch, I guess, ergo the E2, right?
Right.
What was the big change, the waterproof part of it, or was there anything else?
Waterproofing is a big part of it. Having a better, more responsive fitness tracking system is a better improvement in it. And it's also slightly larger than the last version, which isn't always a feature. It's always kind of funny talking about watches for techie people. Techie people want watches to be smaller and thinner and lighter, almost like they're not there. Whereas traditional watch people kind of want them, a lot of them anyway, want them to be kind of larger and more substantial as they sit on your wrist.
All right. The Tick Watch E2, there is a budget-friendly phone available at Cricket Wireless. It's the Nokia 3.1. What makes it a solid choice?
Well, for one, it's really kind of funny to be in 2019 and talk about Nokia making phones that are kind of exciting. that's just not a thing that I've been able to do for a while. Nokia has a series of phones that have been available across several different carriers. And the Nokia 3.1 Plus is kind of a larger phone that is now available on Cricket for $160, which is kind of surprising. And the phone looks very much like it almost looks like Google's Pixel 3 in its kind of build quality, which is a really kind of astonishing thing, given that a lot of times when you get down into this kind of cheaper price bracket, things tend to just not look quite as nice. But the design here is really kind of future looking.
But that's ridiculously inexpensive. Where are they cutting corners?
Oh, they cut corners in a couple of pretty obvious places. The camera is not super great, for starters. The hardware that's inside of it is kind of intentionally cut back, so you're not going to be able to do a ton of things all at once. I noticed the phone kind of slowed down a little bit when I was trying to listen to a podcast and play Pokemon Go and talk to someone on the phone all at the same time. And yes, I do occasionally listen to a podcast and talk to someone on the phone at the same time. It makes my wife very angry with me. When trying to kind of push those things all at the same time, it causes it causes a couple of problems where the phone clearly isn't designed to handle all of those tasks at once. But if you are the kind of person who is just kind of checking email and browsing and occasionally streaming music, you're not really going to notice any point in which this phone feels slow. It's really just when you start to do a whole bunch of things at once that you notice it.
How about the camera?
The camera is okay. It's neither the front nor the rear camera are particularly great. And actually, the rear camera is actually a pair of cameras that is designed to do the kind of zoom in effect that you would get from even kind of a higher end camera. But in both versions of the camera, you'll notice that it doesn't capture a ton of detail, and the camera itself is a little on the slow side.
So, what is this, good for a teenager, a first phone, that kind of a thing?
This is a fantastic first phone for a lot of people, especially younger people, but even people who just don't really need a smartphone for a whole lot more than just Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Russell Holly, thanks as always for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly, Android Central contributing editor. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.